I find in my design career, there are no more engaging projects than the ones that have a direct impact. And this company that we're talking to today, Conservify, is doing just that. They're building things that are going out and helping citizen scientists, helping research scientists, and monitoring the environment to go and help save the world. Throughout this conversation, we'll talk about things like modular design, which is an interesting technical concept that then is applied to a manufacturing and a design capability. At the end of the day, they're building something called FieldKit, which is in pre-order now, should be available soon. So if you know of any scientists who are looking to monitor the environment, if you're a scientist or you're looking to monitor the environment, I think this is like a really great fit for you. And I'm really excited for the things that Conservify has been doing in the past with their past projects and this new one coming up. So I hope you enjoy this interview with the Conservify engineering team, talking about FieldKit and talking about saving the world. All right, we're here with the Conservify field team, and we're going to be talking about the FieldKit today. And so welcome, guys. Can you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. I'll start, and then I'll pass it on to Jacob and Bradley. So my name is Shaw Selby. I am an engineer, but I usually call myself a conservation technologist. And what that sort of means in relation to the work that we do is we try and develop technologies to help with issues around wildlife conservation, environmental protection, anything in that sort of realm. And so being a conservation technologist is kind of a new thing. And so what we try and do, I started an organization called Conservify, whose mission is to partner with institutions that are out in the field. That could be like a nonprofit or a university or a community that's doing some sort of conservation work, and they need a technology solution for it. And so Conservify as a nonprofit would help them design that technology solution and test it and build it and everything, and then deploy it out into the field. And so that's something that, you know, we'd been doing for a couple of years, and that took us to projects on, you know, glaciers in Banff National Park, in the Amazon rainforest. We've worked in all over sub-Saharan Africa and the Congo Basin within Africa, so rainforests within Africa, lots of different projects all over. It's been quite exciting. And the work traditionally will kind of run a full gamut of the sort of stuff that we've worked on developing before. We've worked on like smartphone apps, drone programs. But the majority of a lot of the stuff that we had been doing was focused around sensors and you know, that's kind of what led to the FieldKit project that we'll talk about mostly today. So I'll save the history for that, but we'll go through and introduce the two other team members that are here today.
Great, great. And Jacob, how about you next? Hi.
Yeah, my name's Jacob Llewellyn. I'm a principal engineer at Conservify and the principal engineer on the FieldKit project. And my goal is just what it says right there. I basically juggle a lot. Until we brought on Bradley, who will introduce himself shortly, I was helping out. I was doing the hardware mostly, but now, thankfully, my job is software mostly.
Yeah. I was going to say sometimes you really go to great heights for the company. It seems like
that I think is probably one of my most favorite experiences so far. That picture.
And so people just listening, this is Jacob up in a tree. I mean, I can't tell. I mean, it looks like what 20, 30 meters off the ground, maybe more.
Yeah.
About that. Yeah. Very safe, as you can see. I was in very good hands. I was there with a friend of the company, Peter Houlihan, who's a great guy. And this particular thing is us installing LoRa gateways up in the trees in the Jaw Reserve in Cameroon. But yeah, Jake Lawn, engineer, head nerd, head field nerd, I like to say sometimes.
So. Yeah, and you know, I'll just quickly say that picture is a perfect example of the kind of work that we do at our company. So, you know, Conservify has this engineering lab in Los Angeles, and also a lab in Connecticut. But that lab is full of things that you would use to build electronics. So, you know, like, and 3D printers and all that sort of stuff. But we also have kayaks and ice axes and, you know, tree climbing gear and all sorts of stuff like that. So it's kind of a cool place. But let's talk to Bradley as well.
I'm Bradley Gothrop. I'm a hardware designer which is a term I use to keep from being berated by proper credentialed engineers. But yeah, I'm the guy who spends his time mostly in Eagle and at the electronics bench, trying to make sure all the hardware behaves and trying to keep as much of it as possible off of Jacob so that he can be code monkey all day, which is where he is happiest.
Right, right. In the trees or in the code, one of the two, right?
Yeah. I think the trees are preferable, but I don't think it quite works out that he could do that as much as he would like.
Right, yeah.
Not a lot of power up in trees.
That's right. Well, yeah, you got a solar panel, but, you know, if the sun's not shining, you're in trouble. I think so. One of the things I'm really excited to talk to you guys about is just like, so the company's called Contextual Electronics here, and we talk about how to actually get, you know, why are electronics out in the world in the first place? I just feel like this is such a great example of it. It's helping monitor the environment, helping monitor animal populations out in remote areas. And it just seems like such a great application of electronics. One thing that is difficult, and maybe you guys can speak to up front here, is just the electronics are delicate, and this does not look like a super friendly environment for electronics. So how does that all work out?
Jacob definitely has lots of thoughts about that. But I think largely we're putting electronics in the worst possible environments you can imagine to put them, right? Rainforest. The first project that we really tried to do on a big scale was in a wetland. So you have to think about all the environmental stuff that you have to pay attention to when you're doing that sort of stuff. But just before we get into that specifically, I'll say one of the cool things about the work that we do is in the conservation space and kind of the environmental space, technology is usually seen as something that was always a little bit of an afterthought, or like if people are using technology in the field, they're either doing one of two things. One, they just happened on something that was used before and now they're using it for conservation purposes, or two being, you know, they're buying it from maybe the one company that builds that sort of thing, or there's a couple options out there. And those companies that are building sensors and other sorts of technologies in this environmental space tend to be a little bit older and kind of slow moving. And so one of the things that we've been really trying to think about is like, how do we leverage like just the insane amount of innovation we've seen in the electronic space over the last, like, you know, 10 to 15 years, and reimagine some of these same systems, but like in an open source capacity. And so I think that's the first thing is like using these tools in the field. Like we're bringing in maybe similar tools that people have used before, but like trying to restructure them and use an architecture that's much more modern and open source. And so that's kind of a new thing.
Yeah, kind of like how a lot of like modern consumer space companies are using off-the-shelf components that are obviously they go and they characterize them and they make sure they're going to be designed in a safe environment and usable up there, but still putting the mass market available electronic components out in the world. It's not some super specialized thing. You're not making Conservify branded resistors because you need to have that super spec. You're using all the things that are available, but then they go into these very should we say wet environments? I mean, is that a fair thing to say? As we see another glamour shot of Jacob hanging over the side of a boat and soldering. Is that soldering there?
I have a butane soldering iron that I'm using right there, and that was my first encounter with leeches, actually. And
speaking but not your last.
The health benefits are
just off the chart.
Yeah. You know, I will say that, you know, I think people that are in the hardware, doing hardware work, are used to sort of designing for their customers and their people. And we definitely have there's a lot of that we have to do because many of our customers your users are very unique in that they're unique for the goals they have with the hardware and where they're at. But also there's nature. And that's another thing that is something we think a lot about, like when it comes to like cabling and UV and batteries and temperature and all that kind of stuff, and anticipating what people want to do with the hardware is a little more than what you might have to do anticipating what they're going to do with like a consumer product that has to see, you know, just a commute and time at home and time at the office. It's a lot of thinking about things that you're not used to thinking about. And so field work is very important as creating that feedback loop about, you know, okay, what worked this time around and what didn't. I'll let others.
say when I started with FieldKit, one of my early commitments to Jacob was to produce a hardware platform that would not require him to lean off of the side of a boat with a soldering iron ever again.
That's a good opening offer. You know,
yeah, that's a goal of of mine. Yeah. And the other one was that, kind of speaking to what Shaw was talking about earlier, that we would try and position the platform in a place where the hoses of money that are being spent by large corporations are hitting us right in the face. Where you can really take advantage of the things that other people are spending their R&D dollars on.
You mean using like off-the-shelf chips and the explosion of available components from smartphones and similar
you want to be where other people's research dollars are strongly in evidence. Mm-hmm. And that's the sweet spot for small players in general, and anyone who's, it's an overused word, but anyone who's doing disruption, right? Mm-hmm. Because the reason why that stuff is cheap isn't, you know, any kind of natural law. It's because the parts that we're using are being used elsewhere in the industry in million counts. And so that's the leverage that small players have in the business against established players who've been in the business so long that they have no incentive in an area with that little competition to push prices down. Mm-hmm. They know that people will pay what the going rate is.
That's right. Yeah.
So they're just going to keep doing that until it doesn't work anymore.
That's right.
I would also add, before we get off the weird requirements thing, is we have things that we always run into with our projects. So, you know, do you have reliable power? Will always be answered as no. And like, you know, can I talk to the device like from my home? Like, do we have communication? That's probably not right. And so we have to think a lot about how we design things that work within that context. Now, we do have like some situations where we can leverage things like LoRa and stuff like that, but still it's always like, you know, we're designing something that needs to go out into an extreme environment and work for a really long time. And like those extreme environments, like I remember leading up to our current Amazon project, in one area, they wanted to monitor water level. And, you know, our partner in that deployment is the Tropical Rivers Lab at Florida International University. And I remember talking to them. I was like, okay, well, water level, that sounds good. And we'll do water quality in that area too. But so you said that there's quite a difference between the dry season and the wet season when the floods come down. What's that difference? And he said in the place where they wanted to deploy these sensors, that difference is 50 meters of water level change. And, and you know, when it's at its highest, like you're not worried about, you know, leaves as the plant debris going down. You're worried about 20 meter trees as debris that's traveling through this thing. Wow. And that will, I mean, you can't, you know, we did a lot of work in Botswana, and like people would always ask us like, okay, your sensors, what happens if an elephant wants to attack your sensor? And, you know, I would just say you would have a flat sensor. There's like not anything we could do
elephant
to protect
wins.
Against that, you know? Yeah. They would win.
Yeah.
That
I'm on the 12th floor right now of a building. And so 15, would you say it was 150 meters?
Or no, 50
meters.
50 meters.
50
yeah,
meters, yeah. Which is like 150 feet, right? So roughly. And so, yeah, that'd be up above my 12th floor.
Yeah, I mean the Amazon, that basin moves more water than any other place in the world, right? So that's just a massive amount of water coming through it, and it's hard.
So Jacob
to
was up
that.
Really high in a tree when he was installing that one.
Thankfully, that was in Africa. It wasn't in the Amazon basin, but
got it.
Still a very wet place. Yeah.
Okay, so we have, I think, sufficiently set the stage for. This is a rough environment, it sounds like. And so there's a lot of interesting things around that. But, and you've also kind of like alluded to the fact that there's, it's a rough environment for the scientists who are maybe trying to implement these things. But what is the historical, like, what do people use otherwise, right? So like before ConservaFi was around, before FieldKit, a scientist maybe 20, 30 years ago wants to go and measure water quality level or measure light output or, you know, something in the field. What do they do? And then let's lead that into what is in the FieldKit now.
Yeah. That's a good question. There's a couple of ways to do it. One thing, and this is something we're trying to solve with FieldKit, is right now the way science is done in the natural world, that science only happens when there's that scientist out there doing the actual work, right? So like the person will spend a couple weeks in the field gathering a bunch of data. When they leave and they go back to their home, that data stops. Like you don't have a way to continue to gather data right now. The way you would do that now, or you know, in years leading up to this, like is you would buy a system that's like built for that sort of thing. And you know, there's a number of big companies that make these environmental monitoring systems that, you know, appealed to these ecology and field science studies. But there's a lot of like inherent flaws in them. One is, you know, if you were to take this hardware and open it up, it's old technology, right? It's really, really old stuff. And one, when we've heard the same sort of criticisms from every scientist we've worked with, one, it's way too expensive. And so like, this is like, when I say way too expensive, I'm saying, you know, they're charging $6,000 for something that's probably about, you know, $200 worth of parts, right? So it's not,
yeah.
I mean, granted there's engineering work and stuff, but like, this is probably something that they designed in the early 90s, right?
A scientist gets a chunk of research dollars. It sounds like,
yeah,
they go to this established company, they buy this expensive thing paid for by that chunk of research dollars. And then they literally fly to the place and camp next to it. Is that kind of the idea? And they stay there for some chunk of time.
Yeah. And they stay there. But the thing too is like these tools are so expensive that only a few scientists can do that, right? Like you can have scientists from universities in the US or UK be able to do that. But if you try and talk to a scientist from, you know, a university in Lima, Peru or something, there's no chance they'll ever get access to that tool, right?
Got it. Yep.
Yeah. I've been, especially when we started this earlier, I've been on expedition where there's glass vials and you're drawing water into glass vials and you're going back and you're taking them with you back to the university or wherever. And that's an even bigger example of what Shaw was talking about earlier, where, you know, the scientists have to be on site to be getting data. And I think it was one of the first things that Shaw sort of pointed out when he got the idea for FieldKit, was like, hey, this is something that can be automated. And what being automated?
Do you mean that they were like writing in a notebook? Is that like what you mean? Oh, yeah. Like they're sitting there, like just they're like, oh, look, the water level has changed. Right.
They have a file and they write the location number on it, time or whatever, and they have a box.
Or the sort of squiggly, analog data loggers of yore you're used to seeing associated with seismographs in movies. Yeah, those are real things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They used to have those in the stuff I did. It was in power plants. They would have like pressure meters and similar things, and it was charting kind of thing, barometer or similar. It's crazy. Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's this is something that happened up until very recently. It still happens in many places. The project that inspired FieldKit was it took place in the Okavango Delta in Botswana, and the whole premise when we first. It was me and this individual named Jer Thorpe, who's also part of FieldKit. And so we came into this expedition team that was doing this transect across the Okavango Delta, the wetlands. And they're gathering all this data. But what they were gathering was like, you know, writing it in notebooks. And then they would come back and they'd spend weeks trying to transcribe those notebooks to Excel spreadsheets. And then those spreadsheets would kind of live in these places. And Jer and I had this conversation where we're just like, this is bonkers. Like you have these scientists that are going to literally the most pristine environments in the world. Like they're looking at just these places that are entirely wild, incredibly amazing, gathering all this data. And that data just goes and sits on a hard drive or more likely in a filing cabinet somewhere. And nobody ever gets access to it. So like, how do we create the tools that allows this information to come out like while the expedition is going on, while the scientist is out in the field? And that idea is what sparked FieldKit to be created.
Great. Yeah. And so
it's worth pointing out too, that when the hardware is really expensive, which a lot of the stuff on the market is, that has effects on what people plan as their expeditions, right? Like if you have $30,000 in essentially glorified data loggers, you're not going to put them in elephant territory and wait for them to get flattened. You're not going to stick them in situations which might potentially be dangerous, and you're certainly not going to leave them there when you fly back to whatever university sponsored your study, because you can't afford to. It's just too expensive. when you bring the cost of all that technology down, the number of data points in a study goes up because the same money buys more sensors. But also, you will put them in situations you wouldn't necessarily put something that cost what the existing entrants in the market cost.
Yeah. Yeah. Then, and to go back to that space example too, it does seem like the modern space industry is like putting, instead of one huge $500 million satellite, they're putting up a bunch of tiny ones, which are still, you know, millions of dollars, but, and more expensive to get there, but a couple fall out of the sky. Yeah. As long as they don't hit anyone, no big deal.
Totally. Yeah. And that, I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. Bradley totally hit it. Is like, when tools cost that much, you only get one, and that just doesn't give you really good data to understand what's happening. You're right. Like, you want more sensors. You want to see things happen over time. The last thing I'll add that was a major frustration for people that we're working with, that we're trying to solve with FieldKit is, you know, if you want to measure more than one thing, that becomes very difficult. So if you want a weather station and at the same time you want to measure water quality, like the way that that has been done in the past is you put up a weather station and then you manually measure water quality and you come back and then you try and correlate all that stuff together. Or if you're a little bit technically inclined, you try and create some sort of interface that brings that data together. But that's like, you know, then you're dealing with two different clocks on two different systems, two different connector types and languages and all this sort of stuff. It's just chaos. And so with FieldKit, we're trying to kind of standardize the way it takes to connect all these things together and really solve that issue that that they see.
Okay. Yeah, we heard from somebody, I remember when I was out, it was actually after the last super conference, we had a scientist, and I won't name drop, but they were there talking about how an entire year had been spent with some poor unfortunate graduate student just trying to time correlate the data from some expedition or another. That it had come in like six formats, not synchronized, so they had to keep track of offsets and trying to bring all of it together. They did manage to do it. That had not always been the case historically, but it was just catastrophically time-consuming and expensive just to get all of it in time.
Wow, yeah. Yeah, and it does seem like, I mean, so we've already kind of, like I said, we've already framed up the fact that this is a very messy process. And so I'd imagine that just, it starts messy. You know, if you don't, it sounds like the traditional way of collecting data is just like maintaining rigor in within your, you know, personal habits and all of, you know, the scientists collect data collection, all that other stuff. And so it sounds like it's just kind of, we're marching towards just trying to get more and more standardized because that is what's been lacking. And so having more data points, like you mentioned, having more sensors in the field, having more time data to correlate, and then having it sent back to a server, all this stuff is going to just give more data points, right? That's all that's what we're really trying to get at.
Also open sourcing the technology, right? That field is all proprietary systems that all have their proprietary, you know, ways they talk to things and all that sort of stuff. And so one of the things we're trying to do is, you know, everything we do is open source. So if you want to take FieldKit and do something with it, you can.
Yeah, it's all on GitHub. So if anybody listening is curious, and we accept contributions. Send a pull request.
I'm happy to look at your pull requests.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Well, let's talk about the hardware itself, because we've mentioned FieldKit. So the company's called Conservify. The project's called FieldKit. What is actually inside of FieldKit? Like, what is the basis of the FieldKit? FieldKit? I don't know.
A FieldKit. This is a debate we've had internally as well.
Yeah, right.
What it is at its core is it's an environmental monitoring kind of sensor platform. So that includes three main things. One is very kind of modular hardware that allows you to mix and match as you like. And we did that in a way so that you can add on new sensor capabilities, add on new communication, module sort of capabilities, and really adapt it to what your needs are. And then, you know, Bradley and Jacob could talk a lot about that. The second piece is an app. And so kind of the idea behind the app was these tools can be very hard to use for some people who aren't trained in like the, you know, to write code and all that sort of stuff. And so how do we create these sort of open source tools that allow people to very quickly become start studying and monitoring their environment? And so that's like, okay, that app allows you to change settings on the hardware. It allows you to kind of download data and do all that sort of stuff. But at the same time, like one of the main issues around using lower cost sensors or even the kind of citizen science field is scientists complain about the lack of metadata collected around these deployments. They don't see it as like real science. And so we built a deployment process into that app that guides you through all the right sort of data you're supposed to collect when you're doing one of these things. So if other people are looking at, you know, your weather station that's in your backyard of Los Angeles, California, they can somewhat trust that data because there's like metadata and other sort of information associated with it. And then the last piece, which I'll go through a little bit a demo on, is a data visualization platform that we built that allows you to kind of, you know, manage projects and sensors and allow you to manipulate the data and share that with people and do all sorts of different things. So,
yeah, it almost sounds like so if someone wanted to just turn their smartphone on and like use a localized temperature app, say your phone is able to capture temperature, it's a lot different from like being able to then change the settings on that temperature versus reading the settings from your computer after it's been uploaded to the web. That kind of like just to piece that all together. And it does seem like, so you mentioned the modularity too. So let's talk about some of the stuff that's actually inside the box, because you guys have a box now. And when I first met you guys, I think you were working on the box.
I think we were just talking about the box.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That's been,
we did. That's this right here that I'm holding up. This is our, we designed our own enclosure for FieldKit. I'll do that so you can see it. That houses everything and it's waterproof. And even that's modular. Like we added this bottom plate that you can change depending on what you want to bring in and out of your FieldKit system. But that houses the hardware that Bradley can talk more in more detail about.
So it seems like there's different like selections. So like it's a lot easier to get started, it seems like, because there's a weather version, there's a water version, there's all these different versions, right?
Yeah, the disadvantage of being modular is that you can sort of drown somebody who's interested in buying your product with options. Right. We did try and make some packages that make it a little more straightforward. But when you open the box, you're presented with essentially, you know, the core of the board and four places to put modules, which actually are what connect to sensors directly. So all the thinky bits are up here, and the memory and the radios and all that stuff. And then these are what you use to interface to different kinds of sensors. And so it's that the standard for those module boards is one that we hope that other people will adopt and that will grow the ecosystem out from where we're at and from the things that we're developing out into some of the fringier, weirder applications. I mean, that it's weird, fringy applications all the way down, because everyone you talk to has some peculiar thing or another that they want to do that's, you know, not a large enough project to be a product. So we wanted to very carefully, very deliberately accommodate those kinds of situations where somebody does not have to start from scratch and design the world's 16 millionth data logger.
Yeah.
And Bradley, can you talk a little bit about what's like in on the core and the lower and all that stuff?
Sure. So the system is fairly straightforward. It's essentially a data logger where you hope to have thought of all of the important stuff. So the thinky bits come as a sandwich. Partly that's because of just density, and partly that's to put a lot of the stuff that you might conceivably injure with your muddy fingers on the inside of the sandwich rather than out where you're apt to poke
that's
them.
Smart.
I think that the term Jacob coined for that problem was swamp finger, where you know you're up a tree or you're reaching out of your boat with your soldering iron or whatever, and you're covered in muck. So
right. Well, it does seem like there will be fewer, like you mentioned at the beginning, and fewer total soldering irons needed too. Because
I'm hoping to reduce the soldering iron in the field experiences down close to zero. Ideally,
right now it's like go pull the next version out of the bag, make sure just see if that plugs in and see if that works instead.
This is one of the reasons why too the app is very important, just because it's few interaction physically as possible in when you're in the field is always a good thing.
And confidence too. It feels like understanding that you see a thing there, you see it's plugged into the water or whatever it's doing, is it actually sending data to you? And then will it collect? Because right. you don't want to come back in 6 months and be like, oh yeah, we didn't turn it on.
Yeah.
Well, we've done that before.
That's what happens. Yeah.
There is this fear that when you're doing something like this and you're in the field and you're standing in 3 feet of swamp water and you're about to walk away and you glance back at it and you're like, are you gathering data right now? that's one thing the app is very nice about, because it's all buttoned up. And you can still talk to it. It's going to time out and shut down its network and just go on for the long haul eventually. But it's nice to be able to have that peace of mind when you're actually, you know, in the field.
Yeah. Yeah. And I imagine, especially if you're working with scientists who are not like, they're not getting in there with like DMM leads and they're like, oh, I'll just check it again. Just check that reference voltage one more time. You know, like it's like, okay. Yeah.
Funny anecdote. We had a deployment in, I think it was in Botswana. And somebody had installed some stations for us, and they were at Rock Block. They had Iridium modems on them, and I could see after it was deployed, we would get daily messages of like telemetry and stuff like that. And one of those things was battery, and I could see the battery just perfect linear line because the solar panel was not plugged in.
Oh
to
that wow!
Particular station.
Yeah.
So things happen, but it's It was a fun little, you know, look at that.
Yeah, no, that's a great example. It's a great example of like seeing data, knowing what's going on, and still not being able to do anything about it, right? It's just like,
right.
Oh, okay, well.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot. It just seems like there's an infinite number of things that could go wrong in these cases. So Bradley, the hardware that's on there too. So, I mean, like, what is the level of like what's on there? I mean, is it more like a cell phone? Is it more like an Arduino? What is it kind of?
It's more towards the Arduino end of the spectrum than the cell phone, right? So we're not talking about Linux on a chip here. We're very conscious about power consumption, which is one of the reasons why that's the case. Mm-hmm. You're going for something a little less intense than running a full-bore operating system. It is not yet the year of Linux in the field kit enclosure, but that day is probably coming. So it's an ATSAMD51. It's the biggest one they make because we have a lot of various serial buses to manage. So that's not a particularly surprising decision at this point. Again, you want to be standing in the path of other people's financial investments so that their money hits you in the face.
Yep. And in this case, I think SAMDs come from the auto industry, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a heavy investment happening there, and there's a bunch of NAND flash on it because you are unwise to trust SD cards. And there's a whole bunch. There's an RTC, obviously, and some of the other essentials. But then there's a whole bunch of
real-time clock for people without the acronym in their brain. So
and a GPS, and you know, a Wi-Fi radio, and the sort of things that you'd expect. And then there's a whole load of power management situations to deal with the fact that like you're going to connect a solar panel and you have to keep your battery topped off, and sometimes you have USB connected and sometimes you want to be plugged into power all the time. And so there are a lot of weird edge cases in the flow chart for the power management situation is the most complicated one on the board. And then the part where the actual modules connect, there's not a whole lot of active circuitry there. There's a couple of indicator LEDs, and there's an I2C multiplexer so that modules can share address space without hitting each other.
Right, because if you have two modules that have the same chip on it, you want to still make sure they can talk
and
back
in fact,
to the micro. And
every module we have has at least one chip that is shared among all of them on it, because we have an EEPROM on that identifies the modules to the core. So like,
that makes sense.
It is always at the same address. It is not always the same chip. Like we use larger ones in some of them because we have data handoff that happens sometimes where there's a micro on a module that can dump some data in an EEPROM and then move it around, or wants to get firmware updates. So like that's a handoff that can happen in either direction. Most of them are real small, just enough to, you know, identify the thing and hold calibration data. But it's nice to have the flexibility.
That's great. We are migrating away from having micros on module. Mostly for power reasons. Is what it is.
Okay. So and what are the levels we're talking about here? So you put something out in the field, right? What is the practical, you know, like size of a solar panel you'd want to have, and then like a battery as well?
We specify a 10-watt solar panel, which is more than we need, but it gives us a good It gives us good output in middling sunlight conditions, which is often a problem under canopy. Mm-hmm. So like you want to be able to pull your 500 milliamps out of the situation for charging current for your battery, even when the sunlight isn't great.
Yeah, and you don't want to miss a day cycle pretty much, right? You still want to get some charge.
So like that's, we don't try and optimize necessarily for economy in the panel just because we want to, you know, squeeze everything out of every photon that we can get. And then the battery that's in the system is about 6 amp hours. It's a 1/3 lithium ion battery running, you know, nominal 4 volts. Nothing terribly exotic.
We're kind of lucky in that in the enclosure, you kind of need a lot of room just to get around inside as like you're dealing with cables and the modularity aspect of it. And so that kind of means there's the battery size was not something we really had to compromise on. In fact, we could even put larger batteries in there.
That's great.
And depending on the scenario, like Bradley was saying, there's a lot of questions about various power scenarios that people want. You know, like there's people that don't want to charge them; they just want them to last as long as possible. You know, this kind of
thing. Interesting. So, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Solutions for long duration no solar panel deployment are one of the things that's on our R&D list right now, and exactly what very large battery systems for FieldKit look like is a question that's being it's actively on my whiteboard at the moment. Because once you start getting into lots and lots of cells, then you find yourself building your own battery management systems and things get a little more complex. Then you're building a tiny, tiny little Tesla Powerwall inside
of FieldKit.
Right.
That's right.
That can get a little messy, but it's probably a direction that we'll have to go sooner or later. Right now, we're telling people to essentially use great big USB power banks, but there are complications with that because our current draw is so low that most of them just turn themselves off because they think you're a phantom draw.
If you can't tell, like we don't benefit with having a customer base or a user base that has a very specific set of requirements.
That's right.
There's a lot of people who want to do a lot of wild things with FieldKit, and we're trying our best to accommodate those.
I find myself answering a lot of questions with, okay, let's walk that back a little bit. What are you? Why are you asking that? There's a lot of that,
Know,
like how long can this cable be? Well, it can be this long, but why do you want it to be really long? You know, there's a lot of those kinds of questions.
There's been a lot of that on Twitter this week. Somebody will have a project in mind and they'll ask the narrowest possible question that gets at what they really want to do. And they're like, can data flow out to the modules? Like, well, yes, it's a bidirectional bus. Data can flow out to the modules, but what are you doing over there?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. But they're just starting with a good negotiating position, you know, like you ask for everything and then you scale it back. You say, I guess I'll just take data flowing in one direction. Fine, whatever.
I love it. I love it because it shows people's minds are just, you know, they see this thing and their imagination takes off and it's great. Yeah. You know, it's some of those conversations are really illuminating about, oh, wow, I didn't think about that scenario. So it's cool.
Yeah, the first piece of FieldKit compatible hardware coming to exist out in the world is a milestone I'm looking forward to. That's one for which there's a sort of virtual bottle of champagne on the shelf waiting for that moment.
So that's someone you're saying doing pull requests saying, hey, I made a module that's custom for my needs, but hey, it also happens to work with all your stuff because I've read all your documentations, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't even have to be a pull request to anything we've got going on, just something happening out in the system, you know, in the same way that like people make feathers and shields all that kind of stuff. I'm looking forward to that. We've encouraged it as much as we can, and now it's just going to have to work its way to critical mass.
Got it. Yeah. So what is the level that you expect people to, I mean, so that's a good lead into this. I mean, you expect at some point people are going to build their own hardware here that will plug into this ecosystem. What about the level of firmware and like programming? So I guess first off, like how much, so a scientist is like, great, I'm going to buy a FieldKit. How much is it just talks to an app? How much is it they plugging in and writing their own firmware, you know, using an Arduino IDE or similar?
This is a problem I think about a lot as a software person. My goal is to take care. I mean, I think there's a lot of common scenarios with regard to sensors and what a module might look like. For example, it's really common to have a module that just has an ADC on it. Or even just to generalize a little bit further, just a really common, you know, I2C component that's on the board that's giving you some data. And I think that is one of the scenarios that initially, as far as the community goes, that we're going to optimize for. We've talked about creating, you know, sort of a general purpose module with sort of pre-built configurations about what might be connected to that module that people are interested in. Because there's lots of kinds of sensor standards out there already. You look at the PLC world. What's the industrial 420? What's the
420 sensor? You mean like a
current
sensor?
Like stuff,
yeah.
So there's things
there's Modbus and things like that. Yeah, sure. EtherCAT.
Exactly. And I think that given enough interest in those and enough sort of infrastructure around those kinds of sensors, it could be really easy for some scientists to say, hey, I'm looking at this sensor, and for us to either say, hey, it's already supported because it's a standard, or it won't take us very long to write up the polling for that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of attention has been given to sort of the pipeline of data as it's exfiltrated from memory, how to make it so that it's generalizable and viewable and that kind of thing. And so data handling is very consistent in that even the telemetry looks like data that's collected from sensors. And so it's important that all our tools handle all that data all the way along. And so this is also especially complicated when we talk about calibration and that kind of thing.
Oh, sure.
Knowing, oh, this was a calibration event, so everything else after this has this calibration data applied to it and so on. And so we're hoping that as we learn our lessons with our modules, the third-party modules will benefit from that experience.
Okay, so it sounds kind of sounds like the expectation is most people are going to come in and use the things that are there to start with, but there's definitely capability to get your hands dirty, really dig under the hood and write your own code, build your own modules, kind of buy into the ecosystem, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that first category of people will never see an IDE, right? Like that, the stuff that's within our hardware ecosystem that we sell, you should never have to touch code to work with.
Yeah. Got it. So they buy something like the weather field kit that basically plugging things together, connecting with the app.
Absolutely.
And then saying, ding, 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 got it set up, ready to go. That kind of idea.
Yeah. And I do think, I mean, my goal is that if you have your own module or you're building on top of a general purpose module or something else that we need, that you might find yourself in the Arduino IDE, but you wouldn't have to know. You'd be presented with this sort of skeleton of an app that Arduino already kind of presents you with, where you have a setup and a loop. And a lot of our modules fit into a very similar paradigm where there's very clear hooks. There is take reading. There is, are you healthy? You know, these kinds of things.
Right.
And given enough, given enough examples of this kind of thing, and starting points where people, this is like, hey, this is for this sensor. It looks very similar to the one they can fork the repo, create a new sort of sensor firmware, and be up and running.
I mean, because you guys have to feel pretty guilty about like getting rid of all the interns that had to set all this stuff up from scratch in the past. You're like, you're killing the intern jobs here, guys.
Coming for your jobs. Coming
that's
for
right.
Your jobs.
Sorry, there, science interns. You guys have to go take actual data and do the stuff you wanted to do from the beginning.
Exactly. Yeah. Why? Like why million, you got your PhD? Right. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Like
yeah.
a million graduate students cried out at once and were suddenly silenced. From the hardware perspective, like the trick of it, if you're trying to sort of shepherd someone through building a module, is giving them education on how not to be bad citizens in the sort of hardware ecosystem, right? Because like a lot of people who might be interested in something like that have never had to even take the sorts of measurements that you need to have in hand to not scrap your battery in 4 hours of operation, right? Mm-hmm. Like being a good citizen from the power perspective is a big deal. And some of these applications, like they'll be plugged in all the time, it won't matter. But a lot of applications, they'll be running on battery. And the thing I expect sort of in advance of it having happened to be dealing with most is people who don't understand why they built a module and now their battery is just cratering. Because it requires a lot of fussy engineering, as we've discovered, to bring the power consumption down.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, so it sounds like the majority case, or at least the starting case, is going to be these people that are just interested in getting stuff out there. One thing that I think about as a hardware person, I'm sure Bradley thinks as a hardware person, Jacob is a hardware dabbler now, software mostly, and Shah is a former hardware mechanical, right? You were a mechanical person before, right?
Yeah, I did.
A little bit of everything, it seems like.
Propulsion, but, actually. I did propulsion stuff. So there's a little bit of electrical.
Hey, batteries can be propulsion too. I mean, like, you know, you just poke a hole in the back and it just goes the other way.
We're aware of that.
Yeah. So the hard part for me personally as a hardware person is that visualization piece. So that you've got data, you've pushed it, maybe you're using Arduino, maybe using, you know, maybe just using GCC even, but now, okay, I got all this data, who cares? But the scientists really care, it seems like. So what does that look like now that it's been piped through the app, right? And then up to the web? Is that the thought?
Right. Stations have the ability to upload on their own. You know, the first question is always, what's your power situation like? And the next question is almost always, what kind of connectivity, you know, how connected right. is the situation?
How many cell towers do you have on the Serengeti?
Right. And if there's Wi-Fi, you know, then you can configure the station to upload periodically. We have a station in the lab that's in an aquarium that uploads data every 20 minutes. And so the app isn't totally necessary for that, but for the most part, it would be. You know, the app is the conduit that the data gets up. And Shah, I don't know if you want to show an example of the portal.
Yeah, I can. So we basically, one of the things before I go into showing it is, you know, a lot of projects in this space, or even just science hardware that's being built, the place that a lot of people fall down is the software side of things, right? They spend a lot of effort on kind of the shiny hardware bits, and getting the shiny hardware bits to run. And then they just figure, okay, you know, once we gather all this data, we'll just put it in Excel or use something else.
Yada, yada, yada.
And, yeah. And so,
who would ever want anything more than comma separated values?
Right. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And this is like when we went and talked to our partners about FieldKit, like we always told them, like, listen, we want to build this in a way that's not, it's not just that same problem that's happening over again. We're thinking about the full thing, like, you know, the start all the way to the finish. And that includes the data platform. So I can actually pull up what that looks like here. If you want to switch to streaming. Can you guys see that now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So yeah. So basically we built this platform to have this kind of, every user will have this page, or that page will have their projects at the top, and then any kind of open community projects. We're also adding this functionality called collections that allows you to compare data even without having a field kit. So it allows people to kind of explore the open data as they want. And so if you look, your projects are here and the different stations that you have here. So if we look, for example, at this demo project, it allows
Shah,
you.
Could you try and zoom in a little bit on that? I mean, just maybe just a little control plus or control scrolly.
I can talk a little bit about the data handling.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a little better.
Yep.
There's a consistent format. So we store. It came up earlier. We're not a huge fan of storing data primarily on SD card. We back up data to the SD card, and the SD card is used for logs and. Various housekeeping things, but primarily the flash memory on the hardware is where the data gets stored, as well as the configuration. We call it that metadata we were talking about. So any sort of configuration change event, any calibration event gets logged, gets serialized to that log. And then the app will download them, and then it uploads them directly to the server. And right. that's the format is, we use Google protocol buffers for that. It's a binary format, and so that's definitely something that's evolved over time. This is a file format that has to support lots of different scenarios when it comes to the modules and the data coming out the devices, so that the portal can do its job, which is showing it to the user without losing anything.
It seems like you guys are almost like I always love the term sneaker net, you know, like that's like the, instead of like an internet, it's a sneaker net. It's almost like you guys have to operate like that from the beginning. So you have to think like someone's going to be plugging into this thing, doing a huge data download, and then upload it later. And so you need to be able to capture all that chunk of, you know, 3 months or whatever the timeline might be, and then be able to like process that and understand that, oh no, this isn't like 40,000 data points in one day. This is 40,000 over 3 months, that kind of thing.
Right, exactly. And I'm glad you used the term sneaker net, because that's another thing where we have to think about offline much more often than I think other people developing, at least apps, have to. I think if you're in the hardware space, sort of offline, like, what does that even necessarily mean? But yeah, for us, like, the app, everything has to work very much. Like, I'm standing in water and there is no, I have no connectivity. And so it is very much like, okay, we have to think about the app in two different scenarios. Like, this is offline, this is online, and so on. Yeah.
Great.
That's true of the hardware as well, because you have to deal with firmware upgrades and all of the things that any Internet of Things device has to deal with, but you don't have the internet. So, like, you have to consider what the ramifications for that are from just the architecture standpoint.
I can walk through kind of what it looks like. So if you have a project page, you have a lot of the information, you can have a team members, and all the details behind the project, and then all your stations will show up right here. So one thing that we do with the stations is you can name your stations. If you don't name it, it generates a name, and it's usually an animal with some sort of adjective. And so, you know, this one is Rural Impala 30 is the name of the station. And if you were
in the middle of
the
city,
if you were to click it, it shows you information like, you know, what the station looks like at that moment. If you snap a picture and upload it, kind of the details around it and where it's at. And if you click explore data, then it loads in the data from this. And so this is just the temperature sensor, and it fluctuates because this thing has been carried around places and stuff like that. But we built this so that you can actually compare different data views between sensors, and you can, like, you know, manipulate them individually or at the same time. It also allows you to kind of, you know, zoom in on data. So if I were to zoom in on this data and, like, oh, this view looks interesting, and I just write, you know, interesting here, right? Then post it, right? The cool thing about it is, you know, if you were to kind of zoom back out to the full view, this data, this comment is tied to that one specific data view. And so the idea behind that was, like, you know, you could have all these different charts where you're comparing different time, and like, you structure this data view into what you want people to see it as. And then that will generate its own kind of unique link that will be tied to the comments, or you could share it on social media, or, you know, make it a reference in a paper or whatever you need to do. But all that stuff's kind of captured here for anyone to see.
Yeah. And we have partners that are interested in one of the things that we've been very conscientious about in designing the three big parts of FieldKit is each one can be taken and used on its own if somebody sees the need to do that. I don't anticipate many people want to use the app to talk to their own hardware, but people are definitely interested in using the portal for data that is not collected by FieldKit hardware.
Do you guys have like a publish format? So if someone's watching this or listening to this, could they just match a similar format and be like, hey, I've got my own box here, but I wanted to be able to show up next to a FieldKit box?
Yeah, exactly. They would definitely have to reach out to me for some documentation at this point, unfortunately.
Which is how documentation works. I mean, you got to talk to someone, you know, like send them a letter in the mail.
I wish there were more hours in the day. I really do.
Yeah, I know.
But we're doing the best we can right now. But it's not possible. Yeah, it's totally possible.
Yeah. Cool. Is there thought, like, I mean, one thing that I think about is the is having some kind of actionable thing. So is it possible? So I don't. So again, to use that water level thing out in the Amazon. So it's at 0 meters on day one, and day two it's 20 meters, and day three it's, you know, 50 meters. Is it like, well, once we're past 25 meters, you know, send me a text message or some kind. Is there some kind of like capability of doing that as well?
We've talked about it. It's not something we're doing a lot of yet, just because most of the places these get deployed and there's no one there to listen. You know, if a tree falls
right,
in the woods,
they'd be underwater. Yeah, they'd be
right. or you know, there's just no cell access, which is one of the reasons why we've played with Iridium as much as we have. But Iridium being as expensive as it is,
that's very expensive. Yeah,
it's not something that's a priority. I like the idea of LoRa as like sort of an alert situation, but it's not functionality we built now. But it's definitely something we've talked about building. And also, I think that's a feature that sort of has to spread across every component. For example, if I come to a station and I sync data from the station, I might want to know. In fact, I'm definitely going to want to know if any of that data looked unusual, especially if I'm standing in front of the station, because that's my one shot at making sure everything's still tip top and ready. In gathering data.
Got it. So it's almost more like diagnostic in that case than it is. That's not necessarily as much data collection as it is like data maintenance, it almost seems like.
I think it's useful for both. I think people are interested in significant events, and they're also interested in the kind of significant event that means that the hardware might be failing. You know, your probes might need to be cleaned or replaced or recalibrated, you know, that kind of thing. So it's connected.
I'll also add, you know, that is a functionality that people have requested already. I think that we're going to see how FieldKit grows going forward, because up until, you know, last Friday, FieldKit was basically only available to people we were partnered with. And now it's available to anyone. And so we've already had people reach out to us. We've had, you know, citizen scientists, teachers, educators reach out to us, journalists, hardware hackers, data artists, like people who want to use this for art, all sorts of different stuff. And so, and there's also like, you know, commercial applications that would work for FieldKit, agriculture, fisheries, sort of monitoring sort of stuff. There's a lot there that people can use for other stuff. So I think we'll see as people buy it, what they end up using it for and how that drives some of the features we implement down the line.
Yeah, I think I even caught myself there thinking like, oh, that like Jacob was explaining, like the fact that it's offline, you wouldn't need that you know alert capability because it's not that sort of thing. And so in that same vein, I mean, so people are doing the science, they're charting this stuff. So you've already kind of alluded to the published in papers, but how else is the data getting used then at the end of the day?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you're monitoring. There's a lot of places that will use it for like, you know, policy around conservation decisions. So, you know, you can imagine you could put water quality sensors somewhere. And if you start to determine that the water quality is going down for some reason, that could be, you know, an industrial thing upstream that's causing that. There's areas where people want to put sensors to monitor kind of sensitive border areas between protected areas and non-protected areas, and maybe like that will help them change what that protected area ends up looking like. And then there's also just like very kind of very specific sort of government decisions that would be made with that sort of thing. So you know, one of the projects that we're starting this year is with the city of New York, and they're doing flood monitoring. They're going to use FieldKit for that sort of stuff. So that the data that's collected as a result of that flood monitoring is going to help them inform, like, you know, what kind of municipal operations they have. And ultimately, you know, if we can bake in alerts and things like that, then like they can warn people that Gowanus Canal is
flooding. You know, Gowanus has its own Twitter account that just says, exactly. Yeah, watch out, here I come. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, that's great. So, I mean, soup to nuts, it seems like.
Sorry, there's also like, there's other applications that we have a lot of interest in. So there's like environmental justice sort of stuff. So we're bringing out the next kind of big chunk of modules we're developing are the air quality modules. And there's a huge amount of interest for that. So, you know, there, you know, a lot of, you can imagine air quality is something that people are probably not going to be running solar powered, right? They can plug it into a wall outside of their house and monitor their quality that's right outside of their house, right? That's something that they'll care about. So that might change the way that people are interacting with FieldKit as well.
Some fun hardware challenges with air quality, huh, Bradley?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on exactly what you're talking about. Monitoring particulates is easy. There's lots of, again, you're in the path of other people's money when you're monitoring particulates. It's a little more fussy when you start looking at measuring contents of specific gases. There are lots of sensors for that application, but most of them require throwing like a watt at a heater
first. Got to keep that resistor going.
Before you get a number. And so frequently at voltages that aren't really available in the system. So now you have a boost supply somewhere to give a dumb resistor a watt of 5 volts just to, you know, make it all go. So like there's some fussy business from the power perspective involved in the AQ stuff. But I mean, this is not the last time we're going to hit those kinds of, you know, roadblocks. Mm-hmm. Like I expect that there'll be a lot of, it's always power, right? Like every time somebody asks, can I hook an X, Y, or Z to field kit? Like there's always the same replayed recording in the back of my head that says, that's going to just tank the battery. Mm-hmm. Like we had, you know, somebody the other day asking about Geiger counters. I'm like, you can. For
200
a while.
Volts on a tube. Yeah.
But yeah, that sort of thing, that's forever the challenge in those sorts of deployed situations. And if you're in a situation where you can plug it in all the time, then great. And I suspect more air quality customers.
Yeah, urban environments and
where they can be monitoring all the time. Like the air quality in the Okavango Delta is not a thing that anybody is like seriously concerned about right now, because there's just not so many sources for those kinds of problems. But in the urban environment, like everything is different. Your connectivity options are different. Your power options are different. Like solar frequently doesn't work anymore because all of the architecture is vertical. So you get like an hour and a half of sun overlight a day. So if you can't be plugged into something, well, now you have a problem that you only really ever had under canopy in the wild. So like as those sorts of urban centric sensors start coming online and people start testing, I think we'll undoubtedly learn a lot about how good our assumptions are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. I was surprised when I first learned about VOC sensors, volatile organic compounds. I didn't realize a lot of those were actually driven from the FEMA trailers after Hurricane Katrina. And like there was a bunch of formaldehyde in there. It's like one of those like weird, that's why there's a lot of them out there, but also it's like a bad thing that led to a prevalence of sensors.
And it's also why a lot of them are so narrowly tailored that they're frequently not useful for our use case. Like VOCs are a thing that interest us to check for, but 99.0% of the VOC sensors that are made for that purpose use math in them to interpret the results that they're seeing that assumes you're indoors.
That's right.
And so it's extrapolating things like CO2 from other things that it's seeing, assuming an indoor environment, and you stick it out, you know, under a Stevenson screen in a city somewhere or in the countryside somewhere, and the numbers you're getting are complete garbage.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. It's that real world hits the electronic world is an interesting interface, to say the least. So I've showed the field kit site. What do people have to do to start getting hands on for one of these things? Like how soon are they being delivered? How soon are they, are we going to start seeing them on the city blocks here in Chicago elsewhere?
We were planning on launching field kit last year, and got hit hard by the COVID train, right? Just in terms of like parts availability and all the things that other people had seen when it came to that. So what we ended up, actually we wanted, our initial plan was to launch on Earth Day of 2020, because Earth Day of 2020 was the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. And you know, if you remember last April, like that was just the thick of like all the uncertainty and fear around COVID. And so we decided, let's hold off and figure out where we are first before we launch. But to make up for that, what we're going to do is we're going to do a giveaway of 50 field kit stations to what we think are the neatest projects out there. So like we put out this call, we had a couple hundred, I think like 300 people apply to it, with their just projects all over the world, really amazing stuff. And we picked our favorite 50. And so we're shipping those out right now. Those 50 projects, they're across 24 different countries. So FieldKit will be operating in 24 countries very shortly. And they're going to be kind of collecting interesting data. Some of them are conservation organizations. Some of them are teachers. Some of them are, you know, just armchair scientists. It's like all over the board there. So we have those ones going out first. Right now, we're also open. The shop, FieldKit shop's open for pre-sale. So people can go and buy field kits if they want. And we're manufacturing at the moment, and we'll be kind of shipping those out shortly. So It's I mean, it's ready for people to use. I'll put a little bit of caveat there. You know, it is an open source project. We are, you know, we put a smaller margin than I think a regular commercial company would be, because we're open source and nonprofit and trying to like create a tool that's beneficial towards a lot of people. So we are trying to sell them, and that those sales are trying to run the nonprofit. That's the structure that we're trying to make for FieldKit moving forward into the future.
Great. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, one of the tricky things about our positioning in the market is that they're all good causes. So like everyone wants to come to you and say, you know, oh, I'm doing this thing and I'm looking for, you know, hardware for free, or, you know, this or that kind of support for my great, you know, humanity centered, fantastic project. And you have to balance that against the fact that almost all of our customers are in that position, right? Like there's nobody wanting FieldKit to explore for oil, right? Like they all want FieldKit to do good stuff. And so we try and keep the prices out of the sort of heights that you would expect in a, you know, if you were the unmentionable company that currently dominates that space, who shall not be named.
I mean, it's tough, right? You want to be able to offer the actual capability, but even, I mean, like looking at the cost is like, it's a high cost, right? It's not like going to be a Christmas present for someone, but it's a piece of technical equipment that could very much change the outcome of a community or a science experiment or similar.
And if you compare that number to the number from the competitor, like there are digits missing.
I think Bradley made a good point. The experience we got out of that FieldKit 50 giveaway was really great, and I think that it like provides us with a lot of insight. So one of the things I'm doing as like as kind of the person who tries to find the funding for the nonprofit is I'm speaking to other foundations and saying, hey, can you help us like fund FieldKits for these sectors, right? Like, like let's do, one of the things that we've been talking about is making FieldKits available to libraries as like a lending tool. Public libraries can actually lend out a weather station to someone for a month or something like that. And they could use that for educational purposes or water quality sort of stuff. And so we're actually developing the program right now, and we're working with a couple of libraries to start. But I think that like that would be something that like maybe a philanthropic organization would love to say, oh, we do a lot of work in the library space and we will fund this so you guys can go and you know build your hardware at cost and kind of put it into these sorts of environments.
You just got to rebrand the project box to be like in a book, you know, like a big book shape, have it flip open.
It's pretty boom, close already.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's got the hinge, so you know, you just need big binding, so. Yeah. And what does better in nature than a book? Yeah. Well, guys, this is really great. Where can people find out more about you all individually and then find out more about FieldKit and Conservify?
Yeah, we're all on Twitter and Instagram, but the FieldKit, not all of us are. The FieldKit accounts on Twitter and Instagram are FieldKit.org. But if you go to fieldkit.org, you can find all that information. I think first, if anyone's interested in FieldKit, go to fieldkit.org. There's a lot, there's like blog posts there. There's the product pages, the product guides, a lot of that sort of information. And we actually,
you'll see Jacob all over the world soldering and hanging off of things. And you should make like a calendar, like a flip calendar of like Jacob hanging off things.
Yeah. I'm one of the things I'm really excited about as more people start to get their hands on these things is pictures of more people using them and there not just Jacob. You know, there's so many Jacob pictures.
There's a lot of like, you know, we moved a lot of the blog posts from our hackaday.io page because we did a lot of stuff. FieldKit in 2019 won the Hackaday Prize, which is like a really exciting thing for our team. Yeah. And I mean, Jacob and I met both of you through Hackaday, right? Like basically, and both of you have helped us in ways. And we hired Bradley basically at Hackaday. So I think that, you know, that's a community that we're really interested in. We have very strong ties to that community as well. So we'll be doing some stuff. There's some stuff that we have planned with Hackaday over the next like year or two that I don't think I'm allowed to talk about yet, but you'll see us there as well.
Okay, great. Well, guys, thanks for coming and talking about this. I'm really excited to see the future of citizen science and the future field kit modules and just seeing these boxes all over every scientific study in the world. I want to see a field kit box in there. So,
yeah.
Thanks for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, thank you.
So that's our show with the Conservify engineering team. I really appreciate them coming on and talking about the field kit. It's a really exciting piece of hardware for a couple of reasons. One is it's going to enable scientists to have better data and have a better monitoring of the environment, which is obviously under duress from climate change and poaching and just all of the factors that human-based influence is having on the environment. And we need to learn to live in harmony with the environment, I believe. The system itself, FieldKit, is really interesting for a couple of reasons. One is it's modular, like we talked about. You can swap out all of these different elements. Also, the open source design initiative there, the fact that you can go and download that, you see all the plans, you can participate, you can build your own modules to plug into it. I recommend you do that. We'll have links down in the show notes. And then the third one is one I don't think I have talked about on the podcast much. We talked about it a little bit in the course before, but dealing with harsh environments is its own kind of area of expertise. You know, the idea that they have this specialized case, the idea that they're conformal coating boards and working to have really reliable electronics is kind of its own area of study. So I think all of those things make for a really interesting product that they're going to be selling. And like I said, scientists are going to be using. If you'd like, you can go and support this show. Please give us reviews on the Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Spotify, all of the different places where you get your podcasts. We'd love reviews. We'd love to directly hear from you. You can always email podcast@contextualelectronics.com. And please share it. You can send the YouTube link. There's a YouTube video. If you don't know, if you're listening to just an audio, there is a video element. We did talk a little bit about the visual element. Or if you're watching the video, you can always just listen to this on the go. There is a podcast in all of the aforementioned places. So please do that. That's all for now. Thanks for listening and thanks for watching to the Contextual Electronics Podcast. We'll see you in the next one.